Hi there, my name's Oisín Lunny and welcome to Audio Talks presented to you by Harman. Today we are diving deep into how the live events industry is rising to the challenge of the climate crisis and what real actionable change looks like. And we are joined by two incredible guests. Claire O'Neill is the CEO and co-founder of A Greener Future, and she's been leading the charge on sustainability in festivals and touring, including working with Massive Attack and spearheading the recent Act 1.5 Climate Action Accelerator. Welcome to the podcast, Claire.
Thank you. Hello, everyone.
And Katie Templeman-Holmes is the Senior Director of Product Strategy and Sustainability for Harman Professional, a global audio and tech pioneer and leader in professional recording, live and broadcast audio. Welcome to the podcast, Katie.
Hi, thank you so much.
I should have actually said welcome back to the podcast for both of you, because this is your second time on the podcast. So I'm delighted to welcome you back, and I'm thrilled that we're going to be jumping into this very, very important topic. So folks at home, if you've ever wondered what a greener music industry could actually look like and how we get there, this episode is for you. So let's jump right into it with a little bit about your personal journeys. Now, Claire, I'd love to start with yourself. What first sparked your passion for sustainability in live events?
Well, I started doing a dissertation. In fact, it began as a degree in music industry management. And during that time, I was also going to free parties in the woods in the UK, where I discovered solar powered sound systems and organic vegan food and a lot of activist movements, I guess, and an alternative way of living. And I thought, how can I dedicate my career to managing an artist or running a record label or something else in the music industry now that I know also about climate change and that we had a carbon footprint and all these things were happening, as well as this alternative lifestyle? And also, how would we take something that's countercultural essentially into the mainstream? And so I decided to do my dissertation about festivals and the environment at that time, which ended up becoming A Greener Festival, which then became A Greener Future later on. But really, it was being inspired by the world around me. Also, I should add, there were things like Kingston Green Fair was happening in the UK. Big Green Gathering had already been going for maybe 20 years. The Green Futures at Glastonbury for decades. And so there was all this great stuff, but it just was not part of the normal way of doing things. And I figured it should be.
Well said. So you mentioned there A Greener Festival kind of transformed into A Greener Future. So talk to us a bit about how A Greener Future started and what its focus is today.
So it started, like I say, I did that piece of research at uni, and then my lecturer at the time was actually the lawyer for Glastonbury, who is an unexpected asset as far as sustainability and events is concerned. And he was like, what are you going to do with this? So we turned it into a website with my classmate at the time, Lou Cowell. And this was in 2005 or 2006, maybe. We put the research up there, and festivals all around the world started to get in touch, either to say, we're doing this, we're working on this, or we want to learn more, we want to do more. And so we decided to set up initially like a short checklist and a Greener Festival award. And that was like maybe 20 questions, things like, do you recycle? Or like, have you got composting? And it's very straightforward. Do you use renewable energy? And then over the course of about 10 years, that kept developing. So the certification that it's become today was being developed year after year, through learning best practice, scientific developments, and collaboration with various environmental scientists and things like that. And then we realized people are actually using this for things like license hearing and tender applications. So we need to kind of professionalize a bit, because at first it was just to raise awareness and get people doing anything. But then as it grew up, we thought we should probably grow up a bit in the way we're doing things. And we started training assessors internationally. And that was also so we didn't need to fly around to tell people how green they were or not. I was also at the time being an aerialist, and I was traveling the world with Arcadia Spectacular as an aerial circus performer. And we had like 5 shipping containers, 55 crew, and we were going into Taiwan, China, Thailand, Miami, all over the world. And I could see firsthand the lack of sustainability in a lot of touring practices. And we developed a green rider for that tour. Additionally, through the festival, saw that when we get to kind of main stage, technical production, headline artist realm, any of the sustainability policies or actions, it kind of stopped there, because I think that the festivals felt they didn't have the authority to tell the big boys what to do. However, I'd seen from the other side of it that a lot of artists did want to do something, or the productions were able to change things or wanted things to be different as well. So we took the Green Artist Rider to Coda Agency at the time. Subsequently, they became Paradigm, and now they're part of Wasserman. But they released this Green Rider that then meant a lot of artists were getting involved, but it also brought the venues into the fold because they were going out on arena tours or stadium tours. And then the venues got in touch to say, well, we're doing this action, or how can we implement this? That doesn't quite work for us, but, you know, we've got problems with the production that's coming in. So then we realized, okay, we need to be looking at every part of the ecosystem, actually, not just, you can't use one section. There was a lot of finger pointing happening, and therefore like, oh, we can't do anything because they're not. So it was thinking, okay, how can we get everyone kind of pushing in the same direction and understanding and learning from each other? And that's pretty much how it evolved from being specifically about festivals. There's a lot more in it, but I don't want to talk forever. We also started working with sports events and ceremonial events and cultural events and all the rest of it as well. So it's been a bit of a journey.
You can say that again. That's brilliant. It must be one of the most interesting CVs out there. The Aerialists are working with Arcadia and spearheading this whole green revolution in, you know, music and live culture.
I have to say, I can't take credit for spearheading Act 1.5. I've been a very lucky person to be a part of it, but it's actually been spearheaded largely by somebody called Mark Don, by John O'Sullivan, the Massive Attack team themselves, Tyndall Centre for Climate Change Research.
Great to give him a shout out on the podcast. That's brilliant. And speaking of interesting CVs, now, Katie, the last time you spoke on the Audio Talks podcast, you mentioned that you spent a lot of time in these top-end recording studios, enormous mixing desks, and really your whole path through your work at Harman in terms of products, in terms of manufacturing, has really been informed by this lifelong passion for recorded and live music. So I'm curious to know, what drew you to the sustainability side of things from the product and manufacturing side of the industry?
It doesn't involve being part of a circus, so I'm going to seem terribly boring after Claire. But yes, absolutely. You know, I think one of the things actually Claire touched on of just, you know, other people do care too. This isn't like this personal mission necessarily. It's one that's part of our community. And I think that's one of the really wonderful things about this industry, about this sector, is it's that it's a community and everybody taking some responsibility, whether it's just an interest in learning, and that's fine. Others taking action and being involved, and then people such as Claire and her cohorts who are leading the way for everybody. You know, that's really inspiring. So from the manufacturing side, it's just looking at it to say, how do we do our bit? And again, the learning is where it begins, of just becoming educated so that we can be informed and know what is our piece of the puzzle here. And in turn, then we can start to act and help develop things and move us forward positively. And so, yeah, honestly, it's really, again, it's not a very exciting story.
I think it's exciting.
It's just the inspiration of all of it and a true interest in it and an absolute desire to do and be better.
Phenomenal. And, you know, you've been at Harman for quite a while. So I'm curious to know, how has the atmosphere at Harman changed in terms of its approach to environmental impact? You know, what are some of the things that you've seen while you've been there? Because you've got a real superb insider's perspective.
I do. I've been buried in here for 15 years. But it's been brilliant. And it's been 15 incredible years. And to your point, certainly a journey and an evolution as a huge global corporation, right? So there are lots of moving parts in here that change and still need to change and improve. But again, it's that internal community of what I've really seen change is the effort and interest to learn. Like it comes back to just such a basic thing of, you know, what are we doing? What are we doing wrong? Can I help a bit? Am I part of that? You know, and seeing that change, seeing it from a point of the business understanding and wanting to make a change and to lower their footprint overall, helping us learn as the employees in the business through training programs, education. We have an entire department for ESG. We have policies, we have ERGs, which are like groups within the company to learn and understand in what you might call sort of special interests or sectors of our society and community. And just the sharing, the education that gets spread through, holding ourselves accountable, targets are set for the business. We voluntarily report on our sustainability efforts. And the whole thing is just building, it's building, and it keeps going. It's a really exciting time for the business.
Oh, fantastic. I get a real sense of that momentum there that each of you is contributing to and amplifying as the company moves ever faster in that direction of sustainability. Wonderful, wonderful. So, you know, we're talking about challenges in the industry. We also are looking for examples of impact. So, Claire, I would love to put you on the spot and ask you, what would you say is one major challenge for making festivals or tours greener, and also one win that you've seen?
I'd say the big challenge, it actually relates to what Katie was just saying, because it's essentially about changing culture, because that's one of the hardest things, I'd say, of all change. And it can also be one of the biggest obstacles to accepting change. So to give an example, we went out after, it was the first arena tour back after the pandemic, was Bring Me the Horizon. I think it was maybe 6 or 8 arena shows. And it was incredible because it was the first time there were like crowds of thousands of people together again, celebrating to music, which was just like, I was in tears looking at the happy people singing along. It was fantastic. But we were implementing a sustainability program. We're trying to make it as green as possible. And it was fantastic that there was the promoter, the agent, the artist, the tour manager, production manager were all on board, and the O2 contributed as well, which was the last place for the gig. And there were lots of things we were trying to implement, like plant-based food. At the time, we were looking at HVO very favorably, and then we were just switching the truck energy from diesel to HVO. We could talk about that in more detail later, but at the time, it seemed really good. But then just before we went out on the road, there were a lot of changes that happened to the design of the show, and therefore people were more stressed before they went on the road. And that made it a lot harder to implement anything that was different or challenge the status quo. There was also the speed and intensity of touring, which is how it's kind of been built. So you don't really have time to do things with much care necessarily. I mean, you can do things outstandingly slick and professional, but not necessarily sustainably. And then the choice of routing as well. There's one show in Glasgow followed by a show in Cardiff, if I remember rightly. But they were one day after the other, which meant that we had to send a separate crew out in advance, or a few people needed to fly there to get there in time. And that's because of the way that we've built the behavior, I guess, of the industry. And then that kind of follows the money and the deal structures as well, because the way that the money flows relates to how the energy flows, actually, because it influences what people do and where they go and how they operate. But then there's also that more kind of entrenched culture where it's like, it's the rock and roll attitude, this is how we do it. And it can be quite macho, actually. And then when younger people are coming in, if they learn those same way of doing things, it's quite hard to turn the dial. But conversely to that, and I should say that it was actually, I've highlighted all the negatives there, it was actually a great success. But it highlighted the difficulty of culture, and especially if you're trying to change people's meals.
Yes, wow.
But then something that's been really positive this year has been, I teamed up with Dale Vince, who started the world's first green energy company in the UK and does lots of other fantastic things. And we started Grid Fairies, which is powered by Ecotricity, the green energy company. The initial intention is to get diesel and get fossil fuels out of events. And so the aim is to connect them to grid, to have that grid powered by renewables. But then we ended up with a battery. So we got this huge 1 megawatt battery that initially was used on the Arcadia site at Glastonbury, the people that I've been doing the circus tours with, because they had this new dragonfly stage and they wanted to be all powered sustainably. We couldn't get part of Glastonbury onto grid so quickly in such a short space of time. So the battery came in and powered the whole of the dragonfly arena. And it was the first time that it got used. So that was quite, but it worked. And then we took it to WOMAD afterwards. And then we took it to power the main stage of the Massive Attack Act 1.5 Climate Action Accelerator show in Bristol. And that was, the whole event was powered by battery that time. And it was all charged by renewable energy from the grid. And it was the first time that it was done without any backup, like, so no diesel backup, no generator backup, and we didn't have grid on the site either. So that was quite nail-biting as well, but it worked. And what's great about that is batteries have been used on sites before, but they've never powered a main stage of that scale that's with a big commercial promoter. And so that's really opened the doors for people to go, oh, this technology actually works. And it's also something that helps with the macho rock and roll culture, because it's big ass toys that people like to play with. The whole show was plant-based, by the way, which is also very important. Like you were saying, Kate, about the manufacturer's role, in order to be able to do these changes to transition to things like green energy, we really need to have clearer data about what what energy consumption is, and also lower energy consuming, but really still impactful, like wow factor kit. And there's a big divide in that at the moment that, yes, there are, is energy efficient equipment, but in the live sector, there's a lack of understanding and knowledge about this is how much energy this kit is going to draw while it's being used. And so it gets massively overspec'd how much power is needed. And that means that people either think you can't use alternatives or we burn way too much fuel. So that's somewhere where I see a real kind of teaming up between the live sector and manufacturing as well.
Perfect answer. And, you know, we'll definitely link to Grid Fairies in the show notes. Of course, that's amazing work that Dale is doing in many, many different arenas, particularly politics. But Claire, staying with yourself for a moment, you mentioned there's an expectation of kind of big macho equipment, and it's kind of the culture of live music.
I'm being a little bit unfair, but it is true.
You know, a fair reason. There's a reason why all this equipment is massive. You know, we had, like, the previous guy in the podcast was the gentleman who designed the speaker stacks at Woodstock. And you're talking kind of monumental speaker stacks. And he was involved in the wall of sound design for the Grateful Dead, all this kind of stuff. So its heritage is these kind of mega rigs for mega gigs. But, you know, Claire, when it comes to sustainability in live events, what do you think is a myth that you'd love to bust? What is one thing that's maybe, you know, people are expecting things to be a certain way, but actually they can be different now?
I was thinking of a number of other things, but actually, with your preface, I'd say that a myth would be that sustainability means less, and that sustainability means kind of a not quite as good version as the unsustainable. It's actually the other way around. Like, you can have some seriously mind-blowing, amazing, futuristic, super slick productions that do not require 12 trucks. And if you're using 12 trucks, you're kind of unimaginative, actually.
Indeed. And Katie, we just heard like some great examples there of the importance of a cultural change as much as anything, the importance of busting through myths when it comes to sustainability in live events. But from your perspective, when it comes to audio and stage tech, where do you think the biggest sustainability gains can be made?
Everything Claire said, it's power, power, power. That's it. That's the big hungry giant in all of it. Certainly from the technology perspective and in the products that we're supplying and other businesses are as well, the power consumption of each one of those black and silver boxes that you see dotted all over, right? Like every single one of those is drawing something. And to Claire's point, like it's amazing and just so incredible that they've already started to do so much of actually greening and moving away from diesel at the events themselves. That's incredible. The other side of it is you've got fixed venues, right? And fixed venues aren't necessarily going to adopt and use what you bring in. Sometimes you use things that are house. And so in those instances, if Claire and her team and other production companies don't get the choice to bring in, for example, alternatives for power, it really comes down to all the equipment that's being used and the power consumption that they are actually going to draw straight from a standard grid. Right. So from the tech perspective, and I love what Claire said, because it is what we need to be asking, is what's the data behind the products being used? Because every single one of the products, even though you might say, well, a speaker's a speaker's a speaker, I've got a JBL speaker and then they've got a different make of speaker. Right. But every one of us and all of our products that we make, they have a carbon footprint in of themselves, both in how they were manufactured, their entire life cycle, but then a big piece of it, because we have done some of that data work in Harmer Professional, is looking at where is, again, that big beast. And it's in the power consumption, it's in the usage of the product. So even less the design of it, it's actually, and the materials being used, sort of some of those things I think we would naturally gravitate to be like, oh, you know, make sure you use recycled plastic or recycled aluminium or what have you. Yes, yes, and yes, all excellent things to be doing and all work that we have active right now in Harman Pro. But again, the big juicy one, it's the power consumption. So how all of that advances and everybody being able to provide data for their products to say, this is the carbon footprint, and then this is the energy consumption of it, so that then there can be conscious decisions made at each one of those tender points. So when you come in and you say, okay, we're going to go out, we're going to go off and do this, whatever it is, 6 month tour, and they're speccing out what gear they want to take, if they can see there's a greener choice, most people will make it. Why wouldn't you? And to Claire's point, it's not less than, it's the opposite. It's better than, right? There's no negative in this. You don't get a lesser product in the slightest. It's got nothing to do with anything, right? The product is still the product. So I think it's a really important thing for people to be aware of and for manufacturers to hold themselves accountable for, to keep moving and keep improving on it. And again, that's really where most of our work is being done internally at the moment, to try and significantly, materially change the impact of our products in the long term.
Fantastic. So you're kind of mentioning things like the power of the devices, the longevity of devices. I know is a big feature of the JBL and Harman Pro gear. You buy this kit, it lasts for a long, long time. Repairability, you're talking about innovation with materials. I mean, Katie, how do you and the team go about making sure the needle is always moving in the right direction in terms of these different factors when you are developing products?
Yeah, I mean, you sort of pulled out all the headlines there in a good way, because that's what we do, right? You look at the circularity of a product, and that's really the ultimate intention. Everywhere along the line, from the design of it, from where you're taking the materials from, like the origin of the material itself, what the material is, how it then can be used in the design of the product, the physical footprint of a product, right? So again, can I do more with less? Can I make this physically smaller? It's a really basic concept, but just, can I make this smaller? Often, yes, you can. Some things are harder than others. And then looking at, again, making sure this thing stays alive. Can I pull it apart? Can I repair it? Can I repair it on the road so I don't have to dump it and bring in another one? Yes, yes, and yes. So making sure that all of that is there, making sure that they are IP rated products so that you get the durability, making sure that we're using the right types of materials in the construction of the product so that they are rugged, right? If you take a VTX rig out, I think people would be horrified if they saw some of the way, you know, when stuff gets pulled off a truck, right? And it's all being unloaded. And these teams, they do this day in, day out, right? They are just bears. They're so amazing. The crew, honestly, when you see a load in and a load out and the speed and the efficiency at which they do this, but stuff gets bashed about. So you have to design it so that it can be. And that's a huge part of our process. You know, we do load bearing tests that are way beyond the safety requirements and necessity of it, because stuff happens, right? We want this stuff to last and we need it to. So yeah, to all the kind of headlines you pulled on, we're looking at design, we're looking at repairability, we're looking at the sourcing of our materials, the materials being used, how, you know, the longevity of it, how it can be repurposed and recycled on the back end, because at some point its life will be done. What do you then do with it? So, you know, we look at like our manufacturing plants and when we receive stuff in for service and repair, if it isn't repairable for some reason, or if we've just taken in old product from a customer, is we completely dismantle it. So like in our Tijuana plant, we'll break that whole speaker down and we'll separate all of the parts and organize them like you do at home for your compost and your recycling and your regular rubbish. And it's exactly the same. We do the exact same thing with all of ours. Again, we can do more and we can do better, but we are conscious, and that is our activity, again, of just making sure that we are moving ourselves forward and doing it at as many points as possible, again, in the circularity, the life cycle of a product.
Phenomenal. And when you spoke about the ruggedness of the products you're making in JBL Pro, stuff that's going to be like thrown off the back of a touring van, I have had the great privilege of being shown around the Northridge R&D Center for Harman in the USA by the great David Glaubke. And he showed us this room that is like a torture chamber for speakers, and it's where they get blasted with heat and cold and vibration, and it's the equivalent of, you know, being thrown around the cargo of a touring van. I mean, they beat these speakers up, my goodness, you know, like to get that kind of JBL approved stencil on the side, it has to go through a world of pain. It's pretty impressive.
I like the fact that you call it a torture chamber, because it is. It's actually very intimidating when you go in there. It's a bit overwhelming. When these trucks pull up to festivals and events, etc., that trailer might have been parked out somewhere for a week or something. And inside the container, that thing has gone up to like 200 degrees. That product needs to be able to be taken out and work just like it was yesterday, right? And it just be pristine. And that's what we design for, because it is extremely taxing, extremely taxing. Imagine coming out of a sauna and then being told to go for a run. You're not going to do that.
I mean,
no, you just want to be dunked in cold water.
Yeah, you can't function. So, you know, we have to design that way. It's a huge part of JBL Pro and our other brands like Crown Amplifiers and things like that.
I'm interested to know as well, you mentioned about there's obviously some kit that's in-house and permanent fixtures. Have you seen like a move towards like, what's your thoughts about designing kit or having kit that's for on the road versus in-house? Because what we've experienced is there's a lot of like people want their specific type of kit and they don't want to be plugging into in-house kits often. But there is a push to have more kind of plug and play scenarios and more kind of software potentially and making the in-house systems as slick as they can be. But from your perspective, are things moving that way? Where do you see the resistances? Do you think it's even a good idea?
Yes to everything. It is good. It is something that we do. For us, again, if you just sort of focus on the big piece, which would be the loudspeakers, because then everything basically is behind that, taking care of business, right? The power amplifiers and the DSP. So if you end up with the big visible part of it that people recognize, the loudspeaker. What we do is we do design for versatility. And in some instances, some products we do design very specifically for certain environments and certain spaces. But you take something like a line array. And for people that don't know what this is, it's that huge, like big, long stack of speakers that are hanging usually above and either side of a stage. And they're absolutely massive. Those get installed as much as they go out on the road and sort of live a life in a road case, right? They're out on tour for years and years and years, and others are installed in a performing arts center, for example, for years and years and years. Having products that are versatile is really important, that they are agile. What we are finding more of is we are starting to be asked about the product, being asked about its footprint or how it's made or more about our company and, you know, hey, what's your philosophy? What's your position on it? And we're always able to direct them to our sustainability report. We're just renewing that right now with loads more new data and information about how we've moved ourselves forward, what we care about. And it's really fantastic to start actually seeing that become not necessarily a weighted part of a tender or an RFQ, RFP, but it is coming up as a category. So people are starting to pay attention and treat this as a piece of the puzzle that's becoming equal to everything else that's on that document.
There's also been a talk of having carbon budgets as well as cash budgets. I know that they started to do that with a few different organizations and institutions. And when we did the 1975 carbon removed gigs with the O2, that we were able to put a cost of £150 per ton of carbon, which meant that we could make decisions to reduce carbon because of the fact that it basically turned it into money. But what you said about actually being able to put a carbon, embodied carbon measure on your product as well as the energy rating is super helpful for that, because if they start to utilize not just looking at the price, but also what the embodied carbon is and the energy consumption, just helps, like you say, for them to make informed choices.
We also have Martin Lighting, which is a huge part. Lighting, you know, events these days, like, I mean, it's a huge piece of the puzzle as well as the audio. So in live events with the lighting as well, you know, we've just introduced in one of our latest fixtures, additional power settings for it, right? So we can't change how somebody uses our product, right, when it leaves us. So you have to be able to give them the options to be more responsible with that product for how it consumes the power. If you think about your laptop, that's a really easy analogy, right? And it has the different settings. You can shut it completely down, you can hibernate it, you can have it in low power mode, da, 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 da. Having more of that in our products, we already have a lot of products such as the power amplifiers, you know, and they run idle, they're sort of in like a hibernation type mode. Not every instance allows you to utilize all of that. But again, if we can give as many options as possible to the product, to the person using it, to again, make an informed decision. Again, it's really simple. It's like when your dad would shout at you when you're 15, he'd be like, turn the lights off, you know, because no one's using it. It's the same thing. It's just like, turn it off. You're not using it.
That's super helpful. Like on event sites, for instance, if you are still using a generator, sometimes the generator's on just because the equipment's being left on in order to make sure that it doesn't get damp, or, you know, there's various reasons that are given for keeping equipment on, and it doesn't necessarily need to be powered by an entire generator for that whole time. So the more that can be inbuilt,
Exactly. If you can just reduce that draw, just reducing the draw in the moment, you know, that's a big focus for us in R&D at the moment. And again, getting this in our products more and more.
So Claire, speaking of iconic live music, now you were very involved in working with Massive Attack and the Act 1.5 event in Bristol. You gave a name check to some of your brilliant colleagues there. But I'd love to hear from yourself a bit about what you learned personally from the process of being involved. And what are some of your takeaways, or like a big takeaway from the event?
The first thing was the Act 1.5 team really mean business. And that was hugely refreshing because I've been working in this for 20 years, like the kind of theme of live events and sustainability. And there's some really incredible foreigners. I've already mentioned a few people, organizations that have been, you know, doing this for many, many, many decades. But it's not necessarily the highest profile artists or the people with the most influence. It's the Act 1.5 team. First, they'd already gone out and done the research, which was the partnership with the Tyndall Centre for Climate Change. And they found some very, really quite obvious things that need to be done in order to make a super low carbon gig. And they weren't willing to compromise on any of that. So this is fantastic because it meant that all of the partners who were involved were completely on board with the objective of making this a super low carbon event. The headline artists were totally on board. The promoter were allowing it to happen. And so it meant that all of the things, all of the best practice and ways that we know an event can be delivered as sustainably as possible, we were allowed to do. And we weren't told, oh, well, this isn't going to quite work with the sponsor area, or maybe the audience aren't going to like this, or oh, the budgets aren't going to stretch to that. So all of the sponsors were providing something that contributed. For example, Ecotricity is the headline sponsor. And then with Grid Fairies and Ecotricity, we had the big battery that powered the main stage. Zenobi provided a whole bunch of electric buses, as well as Second Life batteries that did the rest of the site. Volta Truck came in and provided electric trucks that had this central steering wheel that could drive the batteries back and forth to the Ecotricity yard to basically top up. So they were like massive milk carts in that respect that were topping up the batteries with electrons from other batteries, which was quite an operation. Shout out to Jamal Chalabi for being part of the organizing crew on that. The other thing was we were able to go 100% plant-based for all artists, all crew and all audience. No stone left unturned, even the milk out the door, which was fantastic. And the reason that I highlight that in such a way is because it was faced with a lot of resistance often. And the way that we approached it in advance is instead of telling people you're not having meat and dairy or this is 100% vegan, we talked about what you are getting. And so there was a spotlight on each of the different traders who were coming in that have got amazing menus and really delicious food. So it was almost like promoting the lineup, but it was the lineup of food. And that meant that we were able to reduce the emissions so much more significantly because the food, whilst it's we're not actually burning it on site, like we're burning fuel often, the amount of land that's used for animal agriculture, dairy, and the wildlife then that gets displaced or, well, destroyed, the emissions from the industrial animal agriculture, and it's not in the transport of it, it's in the actual growing of it and the feeding. So probably something like 70% of all of the crops that we're growing and the soya that's produced is used for feed for animals. So it makes such a massive difference to the impact. And it was super popular. It was actually too popular and we didn't have enough. but at least it proved that people were gonna eat it. That was the one thing that was challenged also by some of the people on the team and as part of the broader stakeholders, but we went for it in any case. Another fantastic thing was that Mark Don, who I mentioned before, had collaborated with GWR, which is Great Western Rails in the UK, and had extra trains put on so that when the gig finished, people could still get trains back to where they could see most tickets were being sold. And the band Massive Attack agreed to move their set so it finished 15 minutes earlier so that it gave people more chance to get on there as well. We also had compost toilets. It was something like 87 or 88% recycling rate, which I've never heard of in 20 years of assessing events. And we composted all of the organic waste and compostable serveware as well and turned it into soil enhancer. And it was just a fantastic, fantastic endeavor, mostly because it was big commercial scale show. AEG was the promoter. And having all of the, I suppose, the people with power within organizing events, being on board, showed what is actually possible if you really want it to happen. So now the genie is out of the bottle and everyone has to step up.
Yes, absolutely. So folks at home, that's how it's done. This is like the gold standard. It can be done. It can have this huge levels of sustainability, of audience happiness, of the band getting involved and everyone moving in the right direction towards this higher purpose. You know, I'm sure there were many people saying, oh, it can't be done. You can't do it this way. You can't do it that way. You've actually nailed it. Yourself and the good people at Act 1.5 and Massive Attack have just, you know, made something possible that folks couldn't have perhaps imagined before you cracked it. So thank you so much. And so this, I think it's a great example of what real change can look like in the industry. And Claire, you said that, you know, people kind of need to step up to make this happen. But Katie, what's your perspective on this? What do you think that industry-wide change would look like in a perfect world? And who should be a part of it?
Everybody should be a part of it. I mean, we're all accountable. From the person buying the ticket and going and consuming the event to all those of us behind the scenes, right? And we're way back at the back as the manufacturer. You know, we're probably the last thing people are thinking about, but we are a huge piece of the puzzle that helped facilitate it. For what really moves stuff forward, I think from my perspective, from our perspective as an electronics manufacturer, it's transparency for showing and sharing. Right? It's really that simple, showing and sharing what you have learned, what you have understood, and helping to educate one another so that we can work together then as a community, because it is a big undertaking. You know, Claire makes it just this beautiful sort of articulate list of, and we did this, and then we did this, and then we did this. The energy and effort behind everything Claire has been speaking to is, it's extraordinary. You can't fathom the magnitude of change that has happened there and all the programs and effort and energy. It's just, it's remarkable. It really is. And from our side, from the manufacturers, it's just like, well, why don't you just do this? Why don't you just do that? It's huge. It's really hard. It's not a lack of willing. It's hard. And with it being hard, that's why it's necessary to share and learn with one another. We're not trying to hold each other back. Obviously, we're selling, we're competitive, we work in a commercial setting. But this isn't about that. This is about providing for our consumers. And they care, we care. You have to talk. Right? We have to talk to each other and say, well, how did you do that? Because we can't figure it out. Or, you know, going to somebody else and volunteering that information. And there are really amazing organizations, something like SAVE, which is sustainability in AV. And that particular organization, all they do, it's a nonprofit. They are just trying to educate manufacturers and consultants and system integrators and production teams of just what should you understand here, and going down really basic to the SDGs, right? Of, you know, here are the main goals, and this is what it means. This is what it means to our industry. That's just like grassroots. It's just really basic, but it's very, very effective and really fantastic. And then longer term, you know, from this transparency and from the sharing, is actually to have standards introduced. I think that's a big piece of the puzzle here as well. And that's something that we've been talking about in the AVIXA Sustainability Council, again, in that community setting where we're talking to people that buy our products as well as our competitors. And we are having a roundtable every month, basically trying to work through how do we jump this hurdle? How do we break down that wall? And how do we do it together? And what did you figure out? And it's really productive, but that standards position that then brings everybody to a level playing field and forces our hand. It's a good thing.
I love it. Fantastic. Exciting times ahead, and the way forward is absolutely together. But Claire, from your perspective there, we just heard the gold standard of what is possible thanks to the work of Act 1.5 and Massive Attack. Who else needs to step up? You know, is there anyone in this ecosystem that maybe, you know, not calling anyone out specifically, but, you know, is there any aspect of the whole live music ecosystem you would like to come more on board with this whole journey towards more sustainable live music?
Yeah, I mean, I'd say that there's people on all parts of the ecosystem or organizations on every part of the ecosystem that could step up more. And then there's also those that are really leading the way in every part of the ecosystem as well. It's not like one part of the puzzle isn't pulling their weight. Everyone's got some degree of power and influence that they should be using, because if one part doesn't come on board, then we're not going to get anywhere. I mean, obviously the artists have got a huge amount of creative influence. They're also the ones most under the microscope for being cancelled and called out on anything. Then there's their agents have got a huge amount of sway as well within our sector. They often hold the keys to the artists. And so the promoters look to them and what the artists want. But then the promoters are the ones that have a lot of influence over what actually happens in the live sector as well. I think it's worth also just at this point talking about those that are now a part of our sector that haven't been traditionally, and that's major global international investment funds, which might be completely not aligned with the objectives of what we're trying to achieve for sustainable events. How we tackle that, if they're the ones funding everything, is something that I don't have all the answers to. However, it's a whole nother dimension that wasn't a part of the sector before. And we do need to look at that quite closely and carefully. But within the sector itself, obviously, there's the promoters, the agents, the venues being the house of the sector. Like your tour is kind of as sustainable as the lowest common denominator of the venues that go in. If you're trying to do everything you can as a touring production, you know, if you need to have top steals for one place, then they're going to end up being out on the road potentially because they weren't available at that venue. If their venue doesn't have renewable energy, for example, then that means that you're going to be using more fossil fuels as you go through the event. But I'd say one area overarching, apart from the multinational investment funds that we need to think about, is food. And I'll go back to food because it's such a huge, huge thing that not just the big companies can change, but every individual with the choices that they're making can change as well. So it gives real agency, actually, and is also not costing anything extra, focusing on food and everybody in the ecosystem being responsible for that.
My goodness, that's a quick win right there, Claire. Thank you. I'm really glad you said that. So, Katie, coming back to yourself, from your perspective, you obviously, you know, have a viewpoint on the world that is very much future focused. You can see things that are coming down the track. You see new innovations all the time. Are there any exciting sustainability innovations coming out of the manufacturing world that we should be keeping an eye on?
Well, it's exciting if you're a bit of a nerd, I suppose.
You're amongst friends here.
Got it. Yeah, we've got to keep it in context. You know, one thing that's really going to change things from a manufacturer's perspective is gallium nitride and the use of that in power. So you can actually reduce power consumption by about, I think it's about 30%. You'll have to fact check me on that one, but that's going to be huge. And so you can start to use that in things like power amplifiers. You can use it in power adapters. Right now, it's very expensive. It's very hard to source, but it's there. Right? It's real and it exists. And we're working on an amplifier right now that has this as a part of it. So this for us is, again, it's sort of a pilot. We're learning, we're finding out, you know, so far just performed brilliantly. So that's going to change something quite a lot. Something Claire was even speaking to, you might not associate it with manufacturing, but logistics, transportation, how things are moved around, you know, for a product to come to fruition, right? You're sourcing materials, you're going from factories to distribution centers to customers, etc. How that product moves around is a big deal. So electrification, we've done things like moving from road to rail where possible. They're kind of small wins, but they all add up to a really big picture, right? So again, we focus on all things like that. And then there's something really cool that I've seen that's not ours, but I'm really into it. So I'm going to talk about it. With like stadiums and venues, there's a few companies and research teams that are looking at the use of bioluminescent plants as an energy source. It makes stadiums look like something from Avatar. It's really wicked. It's so cool. And it's real. The viability to the point of how far you can take it right now, you couldn't quite use it today. But I know for a fact there is a company that is trying to do this. And then you've got stuff like the kinetic flooring. So the kinetic energy from us dancing and getting it on, right, is the transfer of that energy is then, so you're capturing it. And then that's being used to actually power speakers and power amps and everything else, you know, everything around you. So that exists. You know, I think it was Coldplay did that at one of their concerts. Again, fact check me. I'm pretty sure it was Coldplay and they tried it out and it worked. You know, again, it's just like, this is really cool tech. This is really cool, interesting stuff. Again, it's just wonderful to see people, you know, researching and developing and investing in all these different areas, ourselves included. It's exciting.
Totally. And you mentioned the kinetic floors there. Big shout to Lawrence Kemble-Cook and the team at PaveGen, who've been doing this magnificently for quite a while, to the best of my knowledge. And it is remarkable. You can kind of walk down the street. I think part of the pavement outside the White House or at various kind of global locations, you walk down and you see the lights kind of coming on and you get a record of how much electricity you're generating just by being there and jumping on the pavement. It's amazing. So I've got two more questions for both of you. Well, actually, three more questions, maybe. So what is one action that you'd recommend for anyone in the industry who wants to do better starting today? So this is like a silver bullet approach. And we'll start with yourself, Claire.
Oh, I already said food, but I'm going to say it again. And then but then I will give another one because I already said it. So going plant-based is the biggest thing, because you could do that three times a day, depending on how much meat you already eat. And then the other one would be transport and how you travel personally. Choice. I just did a mini tour. I only actually had two dates, but it took me 10 days because I traveled by train and boat to Tallinn Music Week and then Pro Light and Sound actually in Frankfurt. And then the next one will be to Berlin Dance Music Event and then down to Bridge Conference in Croatia, all using trains. The sleeper trains are amazing across Europe. If you remember to book them in time, you can actually get one private as well. But one thing I'll raise on that, that's the thing someone can do, but that's also an ask and something that needs to change, is that at the moment, it's often much more cheap to fly than to take the train. And that's something that collaboration with different local authorities, governments, etc., will really help.
Amen. And I loved watching your kind of tour there over to Tallinn Music Week on the trains on social media, Claire. It was just very inspiring. And we did actually have the wonderful Helen Sildna as a previous guest on the podcast. She's one of my most inspiring people in the whole music industry. Okay. And same question to your good self, Katie. What's one thing that you'd recommend for anyone in the industry who wants to do better starting today?
I would say just ask questions. It's really small, but it goes a long way. If you start asking, you know, not every company is necessarily volunteering the information for various reasons, but there is a lot of really positive change going on in our industry. And ask about it. Ask, what are you doing? What is your philosophy? Even if they aren't able to take action right now, at least understanding their philosophy and become engaged and build relationships with the companies and businesses that have this at their forefront. Right. Like I say, this is something that we've held ourselves accountable for. I think we started reporting in 2019. I think that was our baseline year. And we've been reporting and gathering information and learning about ourselves so that we can start making change and take action. And we are. And you should ask about it. Know what you're buying. Know what you're investing in. Know what you're using. Again, it's a small thing, but it makes a big difference. You do have choices.
The power of questions. I love that. Thank you, Katie. And staying with yourself, what gives you hope, or the most hope, for a greener future in live music?
Young people, actually. Young people, they're making proper big moves, not us old crusty ones. We're trying. We're trying, but we're also trying to undo some of, not necessarily bad choices, but ignorant choices in the past. And I think young people are really exciting and inspiring, and they're putting a lot of pressure, you know, younger generations to change and improve and to learn and be held accountable. And that makes me feel good. My kids, you know, they're like mad recyclers. And, you know, my 5-year-old will gladly give you an obnoxious lecture on climate change. And I love it. I think it's brilliant. You know, bring it on, son. Bring it on.
Well said. Watch that space. Most definitely. Thank you, Katie. And Claire, what is something that gives you the most hope for a greener future in live music?
Well, firstly, I totally agree with that the next generations, for sure. But that's not to relinquish responsibility. And I think that there's almost like a poultice at the moment, it seems, on society, drawing out all of the shittiest elements. Am I allowed to say that? I think I am. Which is making them quite exposed, and therefore it really sharpens focus for what we really don't want to be as a humanity and as societies. And that really adds eco-fuel on the fire to make changes and, like I say, sharpens the focus. So I think that whilst there's a lot of noise and a lot of chaos around at the moment, it's also clear that it's almost the laws of physics that we can't carry on in the unsustainable way that we have been. So eventually, our feet will literally be on fire. And so that means that we're able to make the transitions more quickly, and nothing can really stop it at this stage. It's like either we make these changes in order to have a healthy ecosystem or biodiversity, stop burning fossil fuels, have clean air, clean water, and we can actually live alongside each other, or we perish. They're kind of the choices. So that's what makes me very positive for a greener future, because I know which one most people are going to choose.
100%. Thank you very much, both of you, for that. And I have one final question. It's a real quick one. What is a piece of music that you would like to add to our VIP Audio Talks title playlist? So all of our guests do this. Everyone from Suzanne Chani to Imogen Heap to Carl Cox to A.R. Rahman, you know, they all choose a track. And now it's your turn. And I'm starting with you first, Claire.
So when I was in Tali Music Week, I met this amazing guy whose artist name is Natural Symphony. And he's putting essentially lie detectors onto plants and then reading the frequency of the plants, which is creating melodies. And he's plugging it into Ableton and other servers that can make light. So his band of plants are creating music with him. Absolutely fascinating, completely incredible. So you can listen to the music. It's basically listening to the language of plants and nature. It's called Natural Symphony, The Great Opera by Natural Symphony, but I recommend that you check them all out. It's amazing, and it's really good music as well.
Oh my goodness. That could not be more perfect. Thank you very much indeed, Claire. And Katie, coming over to yourself, we've got Plant Life there. What say you?
Firstly, I'm just excited to go listen to this myself. That sounds so great. I would go with Joni Mitchell, Big Yellow Taxi, because that is all about climate change and the impact that we have on our communities and on our world. So I would pick Big Yellow Taxi. It's a solid as well, isn't it? It's a good one.
So good.
Unbeatable. I absolutely love that. Joni Mitchell forever, basically. That's a fantastic choice. And my own contribution to this episode's playlist is going to be very much on theme. The wonderful Marvin Gaye with Mercy, Mercy Me, The Ecology, which, you know, was released back in 1971. So I think we can all agree we've been talking about this for a very long time, but it's so inspiring to actually speak to two people making it happen in 2025. And thank you both very much for sharing your insights, for sharing your passion, and sharing some real talk on what it takes to build a sustainable future for live music. Thanks to you, Claire O'Neill.
Thank you.
And thank you so much, Katie Templeman-Holmes.
Thank you so much. This is a great topic. I'm glad we're covering it.
Folks at home, whether you're an artist, a sound tech, a tour manager, or indeed a fan, we all have a part to play in this transition. For more information on Claire's work, head on over to agreenerfuture.com, and we will of course include this link in the show notes. And don't forget to keep your eyes on the Harman socials for news of some exciting new products moving us in the right direction, and also to get the inside scoop on when the new Harman sustainability report is going to be published. And if you enjoyed this episode, don't forget to subscribe, review and share Audio Talks with your friends, family and connections. It really does help to spread the word on these amazing people doing such important work. For more exclusive content, some behind the scenes goodies and maybe even some competitions, connect with us over on the Instagram. You can find us at Audio Talks Podcast. By the way, did you know that the power from my podcast recording setup here is 100% off-grid? Yes, this is a solar-powered podcast. On that note, I hope you can join us again soon for some more eco-friendly audio talks. I'll see you next time.